Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. We have an episode of the Afternoon Magazine program from the AM 580 archives this afternoon. As this is a tape program, we ask that you not call today.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a look at Chechnya's wars and the toll years of violence has had on its children. Our guest is journalist Asni Sirstad. Her first trip to Chechnya was in 1995, not long after the first war with Russia began. In 2006, she returned, and she spent much of her time with the orphans of Grozny. UNICEF reports that 25,000 children in Chechnya lost one or both parents from 1994 to 2008. Asni Sirstad tells their stories in her most recent book, The Angel of Grozny, Orphans of a Forgotten War. Here is one of the ways she describes a boy who is about to mark his 12th birthday. Quick as a squirrel, slippery as an eel, lithe as a fox, with the eyes of a raven and the heart of a wolf, he crushes everything he comes upon. His bones protrude from his body. He's strong and wiry and always hungry. His life is a battle with no rules. That from Asni Sirstad's book, The Angel of Grozny, Orphans of a Forgotten War. The angel of the title refers to a woman who, with her husband, shelters homeless children. Asni Sirstad, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, very good to talk with you again. This boy, who we described in the introduction, only a few months old when the first war began. He was 5 years old when the second war broke out. What had he been witness to by the time he was 12 years old?
He had, of course, seen all the destruction of the war, the destroyed houses, the bombs. He'd been living in cellars during the night raids. He'd lost first his father, who went to fight against the Russians. Then he lost his mother. He went to live with his grandparents. He lost his grandparents. Then he got to live with relatives who abused him, and he fled, and he got back to the relatives. He fled again. And when the story starts, he's living at the riverbank by himself in a shack that he's built. And he has this terrible habit to kill. Mm-hmm. And what can a 12-year-old kill? Well, he killed dogs and cats and pigeons and insects and everything he comes across, because, as he tells me later, he says, that's the only thing that makes me feel calm and strong and invincible. So this boy, for instance, also describing of things he'd seen, his after a bomb raid, he saw something rolling down the street, and it was his neighbor's head. So this is a boy who's seen nothing but evil in his life, and he has become quite a mean little boy.
Yeah, his name, Timur?
Yes.
Yes, and he told you, he tells you later in the story that he has this, that he's evil, and he has this burning hatred within him, and he seems almost powerless.
Yes, because one might think that because he, when I meet him, he's at this orphanage and he gets his own bed, he gets food, he gets care, and one might think that so he'll be fine. But the thing is that when you lived so much through war, the war will continue living inside of this child. And he, his behavior is very, he breaks things, he flees, he is not very nice to the smaller children in the orphanage. And this discussion about evilness that comes up at some point, but I also get, I get a little bit annoyed by him always destroying for the other children. And I ask him, but why do you have to always do these things? And that's when he says he's evil. And I ask him, well, is there any way that you can get rid of that evilness that he explains like an evil fire inside of him? And he says that, well, he thinks about it and he says, well, if I kill everyone who's ever been bad to me, I will get rid of that evil feeling. So that is how a boy of who's lived through war all his life talks. And that's his perspective, and so it's future. It looks kind of grim because he has these problems to adapt, and he always draws negative attention towards him. But he's also often breaks down and cries and feels lonely. So it's probably what we would call post-traumatic stress. Mm. But what they in Chechnya don't really know what to call, because this is not a place where there are lots of psychiatrists and psychologists to try to understand these children. They think that this can be that through discipline these children can be rid of their traumas.
Oh. Readers will also meet Timur's sister, half-sister Liana. Would you tell us about her?
Liana also lost her parents and got to live with the same relatives for a while that Timur lived with. It's an uncle. And he abused her sexually and sent her out every morning to steal in the markets, and she had to come home with a certain amount of money. If not, she was beaten up. So she got she became very good at stealing in the markets and in the shops, and just very like angel-like looks. She also came to the orphanage now, just as I got there, because Timur was able to kind of save her from this uncle. But that was after 6 years. And this girl, Liana, she really, from the first moment, very much drew my attention before I knew anything about her story, because there was something with her movements and eyes, and just like sometimes you just see that she carries the story. And the way I got to know her was by doing homework, because these children didn't really have anyone to do homework with them at the orphanage. There was always lack of staff and lack of people. And then I realized that when we were doing maths and we were trying to do English lessons, I just understood there's no way she could remember anything or learn anything. And numbers, like we went down, she's 13 years old, and at some point I asked her like 2 minus 1, and she would say 3, 2, and then on the third guess she would say 1. So it's like she's lost the ability to know numbers or to remember things. And then she asked me, oh, how come I can't learn anything? She was really angry with herself, like, I can't remember anything. And then I just answered, not really thinking what I was saying, but I was just telling her, you know, there's probably so much you need to forget that you can't remember now. And then she burst out crying, and then she told her story, and I understood that that was really what it was about, that these children, when they've seen so much, well, evil, and they've seen the war, they lost so much, they have used all the energy they have to forget, for memories not to stick to them, to just shuffle away things. And suddenly they're back in school, war is over, they're back in school, and they just lost the ability to remember. They've just used all the strength they have to forget. And that's something I've read about in a psychiatrist's book, that one sign of post-traumatic stress is concentration, lack of concentration, learning, discipline in school, things like that. But only through these children in Chechnya, I really understood why. It's almost physical.
Mm. What's their future?
Oh, that's, of course, hard for me to say. It's the book, as you know, it opens very open. It's an open end. Mm-hmm. Because Liana, not to disclose everything in the book, but she also, as her brother, she draws this negative attention that she can't quit stealing. Even now she has got everything she needs. She would steal from the staff at the orphanage. She would steal money for the bread from her classmates. She would take, like, ribbons and money or sweets or whatever she can get hold of. And she just gives it away, or she saves it on her bed, and it's just she can't stop it. So it's just she can't deal with her life. And at the end of the book, she's like, we don't know whether this mm-hmm. is the end of her behavior or not, whether she will improve. And it's I think that unless they get proper help, I think these children are very, very damaged, and probably they will become very damaged adults. And a boy like Timur, who's so aggressive, he would be the first one to change his bricks and his stones that he killed the animals with a knife or a Kalashnikov. And he has got this feeling of revenge that he talks about, that he wouldn't be difficult to ask to join, you know, the resistance fighters or the separatists or some kind of fighting groups, and he might not live for too long. You know, it's as bad as that.
Why do we not hear more about what war means for children?
Oh yes, that's an interesting question. I think there are lots of studies. Psychiatrists. I remember I was working for a while with a Norwegian psychiatrist in Baghdad on war traumas, and he writes his reports, but there's not really a lot of books around, and also I sent him this book for him to just get a scientific judgment on the quotes from the children, whether if he had a comment, and he said that this is just really seldom, that he'd never seen a book or children speaking so openly and so kind of deeply about their how they really have lived through the war and how they live now. So I don't know why there are not more books like that, but it's like you need to spend time. I was there for 1.5 years, and the first when I got there, I was thinking, I'm not going to take one by one of the children to do, you know, proper interviews about when were you born, what do you remember, just like you can do with adults. I was staying around for a while, for weeks, doing the homework, and then only after that I picked out a few of the children to work with for the book. It needs, maybe in our time of everything should go so fast, few journalists have that time.
Our guest this afternoon is journalist Azni Sirstad. Her latest book is The Angel of Grozny, Orphans of a Forgotten War. In addition to her work in Chechnya, Azni Sirstad has reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Balkans. She's received many awards for her news coverage, including Norway's highest honor for journalism. Her previous books include the best-selling The Bookseller of Kabul. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, now let's talk about the woman who you call the Angel of Grozny. Both Timur and Liana were two of the children, of the many children taken in by the Angel of Grozny. And you describe her as having deep, beautiful eyes and looking 10 years older than she is. Tell us about her.
This woman, she is a very unique character, personality. She did the opposite of what most of us would have done in a war, which would be probably to flee, to take care of our loved ones, and just, you know, try to get to live our lives. And she did the opposite. She just went out in the streets and asked, like, who needs me? Who can I help? And she found the most vulnerable to be the children, which she got out from the ruins and the streets, the markets, the riverbanks, as Timur. And first she got them into her flat, and then later she got help to build a house, and now she has more than 100 children to take care of, and hundreds of children have gone through this this orphanage, because she started already in 96 when the war was just 1 year old. So some of these children have are now grown up and they have their own families. She struggles on to keep all of this together, she's definitely given a new beginning, or a new at least a new hope to some of these very damaged children.
Yeah. She grew up in an orphanage. What was her childhood like?
Yes, she grew up in a Soviet orphanage, because Chechnya is a part of Russia, and that also was part of Soviet Union. And this is probably why she has a much more soft discipline than what she grew up under herself. Chechnya is a Muslim country, and during the Soviet times, of course, that was not allowed. So they were not allowed to pray, they were given pork meat, like forced fed with pork meat. They were given sweets during Ramadan so that they should not be able to respect the Ramadan. So it was very much very intruding, and of course slapped, and as they would be in orphanages at the time. When she got older and she got married, because of a car accident, when she was 5 months pregnant, something was destroyed inside of her, and she could never have more children. So this is probably just as when she got to take care of these children, the war children, she also knew that I will not make an orphanage like the one I grew up under, but I will make a family, because that's what I longed for all my life, to have my own family. So in this orphanage, she and her husband are called Mama and Papa, and the children are brothers and sisters to each other. So she wants them to relate to each other and take care of each other, just like brothers and sisters.
Mm. The boys, she says, she told you, after the start of the Second War, had to be brought up all over again. What was she talking about, and how does she go about trying to reach these children, because she doesn't give up?
Well, these children had lived in the streets during a war. So imagining you have, or we all have street children, even in Europe, and I suppose you have here in America, and they will live up under a very tough surroundings. And these children might be much tougher than grown-ups who live on the streets. And only the strongest one or the will kind of survive here. And these children, when they got to come to this orphanage, they would just do as they liked, because they'd never lived under discipline other than their own. So they were still stealing, and there are lots of episodes of how they would, you know, there's like two of these boys who would, it was a big Christmas, even during the war, there was this big Christmas tree in the center square of Grosny, where they climbed up and cut off the top and took it back. And in that tree, they actually hung pieces of a skeleton of Russian soldiers to kind of decorate for Christmas. And things like that, not knowing what could be done, what is not to, you know, what can't you do. It's really, they had to start from anew. And they also used religion. So this is quite strict religious upbringing they have there, as also a way of having some frameworks in their lives. Of course, it takes years for these children to, some of them have, also I have to say that, some of them have adapted. Some are doing well in school, even though they have a terrible background. But of course, most of them, that's what I learned, and that if a childhood is, you know, if a child is broken, if a childhood is damaged, it's very difficult to just think that you can mend that childhood and patch that child together. That the war will still haunt him.
Hmm. In 2003, the United Nations called Grozny the most destroyed city on Earth. When you were there in 2006, what was it like?
Then they started to reconstruct because the actions of war are over, even though war continues in the minds of people. And there's still people, there's a very harsh regime in Chechnya. People disappear, people are tortured, beaten up, they're jails without really any right proceedings. People just sit in the jails. And there's an atmosphere of fear, but the surface is if not shining, then it's they are rebuilding it. But it's the main streets are being rebuilt beautifully. Money from the Russian government to kind of show the world that see the war is over, everything is nice, it's peaceful. Whereas tensions still continue on the surface. But even literally, the houses that I visited very often, the high rises, they would get new walls and new windows, but nothing would be fixed up inside. So you would still have people going from the 10th floor down to the backyard to fetch water, and you would have broken stairways inside of the houses. So it's a lot of this is done for show, but of course it has been rebuilt since the end of the real war. Mm.
Journalist Asni Sirstad is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author, most recently, of The Angel of Grozny, Orphans of a Forgotten War. We have a listener now waiting to talk with us in Eureka on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You sort of answered my question. I guess because it had fallen out of the news, the war between the current nation of Russia and Chechnya is now over. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is over. There's still a few fighters hiding out in the mountains, and there would be every week there would be Russian soldiers killed, and obviously also from the separatist forces. But it's more a guerrilla war in the mountains of the south, and that will probably carry on for some while. And there will be explosives sometimes, even in the capital city of Grozny, explosion devices against the Russian presence there. But the bombing raids are over, and most of the shooting in the streets is over. And the power of Chechens given over to, personally appointed by Vladimir Putin in 2004, is given over to a former soldier, a former lifeguard of his father, a person who has a few years of schooling. So he's quite limited intellectually, but he has no limit to use violence. And this is the person who personally has tortured people, and there are lots of claims against him in the Strasbourg Court of Human Rights, who is now running Chechnya. He is himself a Chechen, so it's Chechens who run the place, but it's seen upon like very much puppet government of Moscow, and the real power is in Moscow, but obviously Moscow doesn't really care about the very grave abuses of human rights still happening in this Northern Caucasian Republic.
Was the primary cause of the war the fact that Chechnya wanted to break away from the country of Russia, or were there other causes of it too?
That was the primary reason for the war, yes. This was 91, so you remember the time when there was this wave of nationalism all over Eastern Europe, and many of these countries got independence of all the Soviet republics. In 91, they were given independence. But then Chechnya, who also declared themselves independent, but being not a Soviet republic, but a republic inside of Russia, Boris Yeltsin did not want to grant them independence. And after a few years of harsher and harsher discussions, Russia invaded the republic in New Year's Eve of 94. And saying the defense minister of Russia said that we'll get over with this by 48 hours. And the war carried on for almost a decade. So, and with 10% of the population being killed during that decade. So it really was a terrible miscalculation from the Russian side, but of course also from the Chechen leadership to be so stubborn and to drag its people into this war, when I think that if you had had wiser leaders on both sides, on the Russian side and on the Chechen side, it would have been possible to grant them some kind of autonomy and to solve this peacefully, and you wouldn't have had all those damaged children and killed parents.
Is Chechnya mainly Islamic?
Definitely, 100%. All Chechens are Muslims, I've never met any Christian, or I see it's maybe you might find, but it's like Afghanistan. It's like if you're Chechen, you are a Muslim, and now with the war, which usually happens, there's a radicalization of religion, and Islam is gaining much more important role than it ever did, and much stricter. And there's also been now lots of infighting between different religious groups. So you had an inflow of Wahhabism, which is the Saudi Arabian, very strict kind of Islam, coming with money and weapon and money for building mosques during the wars, because this was before Iraq and Afghanistan, that these countries have become the symbol for a resistance against the infidels. That at this point it was Chechnya, that this is the place where Muslims could fight a really holy war against infidels, and there was lots of influence from the Middle Eastern countries, and unfortunately also this was destroying some of this very very fragile religious structures that you had in this very small country of Chechnya.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Speaking of strict religion, the current president, Ramzan Kadyrov, he used religion as an excuse to close all the state orphanages. I don't know, maybe it wasn't an excuse. Maybe he truly believed that. I don't know. What can you tell us about that?
But it says everything about that things should be beautiful and nice on the surface. And the surface here is the president saying that we do not have orphans in this country because all children in Chechnya should have an extended family. And if they don't, it's because they don't care about their children, and that should not happen. And so he just, over the night, almost closed all state orphanages. And, of course, what did happen? These children, they poured into the streets, to the markets. Some, of course, were taken back to their extended family, but, of course, there is a reason why they were in the orphanage in the first place. So to go back to a dysfunctional family wouldn't really help these children. And of course, some of these children also came to Khadijat, the Angel of Grozny, came to that orphanage, and she has more and more children that it's difficult to take care of because there's lack of resources.
Hmm. Is her situation... she's in a dangerous position, isn't she?
Oh, definitely. And what she said to me, participating in this book, she said that in this country it's dangerous to talk, but it's also dangerous to be silent, and I'm tired of being silent. And because there's been, the authorities have tried to close her down several times and to take her property, saying that it was illegal, that she got the house illegally, or just, you know, what they can do, coming with guns and trying to take over the place. And she's always, till now, been able to save it. And she now says that it's better to, if something happens, to have the international attention than to be silent. But, of course, she is being watched. What she says is being watched, but someone has to speak out about what happens there. But she's mainly talking about what's happening in the orphanage. So when I went out to report on the human rights situation, I did that with other people because that's also part of the book, and I saw this terrible parallel in a way that most of the people being killed in Chechnya are young guys who've been fighting, and there's this mother who's lost 5 out of 6 sons, and so you have a country with children without parents and parents without children, So that is a. It was a very sad and harrowing book to write. Mm.
The caller that we had just a moment ago talked about a little bit about the history. The two of you had an exchange about the history of this conflict, and I think it would be interesting to tease out some other aspects of this with you. The Second Chechen War, began late in the summer of 1999, and you said this was more brutal than the first. Why?
It was brutal because it was more air raids. First war, 95-96, Russia lost a lot of soldiers, waging the war mostly on the ground. And there was a big protest against the war in the Russian society, especially amongst mothers of soldiers. And you had a very powerful mothers' organization, the Soldiers' Mothers, they're called. And this was a time in Russia that mid-90s, where the society was much more open than today, and there were big protests in the street. You had hearings in parliament, and you had a debate in the newspapers about this war. And later, when Putin got the power in 99 and started this war restarted the war a month after he got into office, He was very aware of the power of the free word, so he shut down all open, outspoken medias. The parliament is now totally controlled by his party, so the debate against the war is over, and he also more or less silenced the mother because there was much less soldiers being killed when you just bomb from the air. There's more damage on the ground. There's less precise, but you have less of your own soldiers being killed. And once they were on the ground, the war was just waged with such a brutality, and it seemed that the Russian forces were able to just behave as they liked, with killings and killings of all families, with rapes, and but you also had the Chechen becoming much more brutal. We've seen over the last few years several terrorist attacks. The school in Beslan with several hundred people killed, the theater in Moscow where also several hundreds were killed. So the Chechen side became more and more desperate and thus more brutal. So the relations now between Chechens and Russians are at a historic low point now, and there's a lot of hatred. Mm.
The Second War helped boost the political fortunes of Vladimir Putin. This brings to mind Russia's recent actions in Georgia. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think for Vladimir Putin, or today Dmitry Medvedev, the new president, it's very important to show that they are strong on the international agenda, mainly for their own people, because I think that we have underestimated the loss of confidence among the Russians in the 90s, that suddenly, when their country broke apart, communism was dead. So everything they'd ever believed in was just, it dissolved, like their ideology, their country, even everything they had was bad quality, even clothes. So everything was flowing in from the West, as shinier and better and better quality. And at some point, it was a great loss of pride. And I think with Boris Yeltsin, in addition to this, he stopped paying pensions because the state lost its money. Teachers weren't paid, doctors weren't paid in hospital. And this is what this was the era when there was a lot of talk of democracy. So for many Russians, when they think of democracy, they think of this period. They think of democracy is not getting my pension paid, is not getting my wage as a teacher paid, and it's chaos. And then comes Putin, and he wants to restore law and order. He never uses the word democracy. That's that's not in his rhetoric. It's law and order, and he wants to restore the economy, which he's been able to do, but mainly through the very high rise of oil prices that Russia lives off, and also militarily. That he wants, he's that kind of person who was proud of being part or member of a superpower. And for most Russians now, even though results of elections are often falsified, this Putin and Medvedev, they would have gotten a majority even without the falsification of the elections, because most Russians, it seems, they do not care about democracy. They want stability. Mm-hmm. That is the word that was mostly used in the election campaign, stability. So it's some kind of a restoring of being proud of something, and it's not important to feel free, but it's important to be part of something, a country that is strong on the international agenda. And then taking us then to Georgia, it was definitely a show of force. And even though we might see Georgia as an independent country, Russia does not. Russia sees Georgia, and especially the separatist, the breakaway republics in Georgia, as part of their sphere of influence. And when we, the West, especially the United States, when they were too present in Georgia, if Georgia had become a NATO member, that was something Russia saw as a threat. Both to its pride to have the NATO border so close to itself, not having Georgia and Ukraine as a buffer zone, that is something Russia, it seems, at this point cannot accept.
Mm. Thinking of Putin and the desire on the part of the Russian people for stability, in that sense of stability, is that why some Chechens have seem to have embraced Ramzan Kadyrov, even though his methods are quite brutal. Many people have disappeared. You mentioned torture and deaths. Are people in Chechnya, are they looking to Kadyrov for stability?
I think some do, definitely, because even though he's a very brutal dictator, you definitely have people supporting him, because now you don't hear, you don't wake up during the night because of bombs or shooting. Another reason why he has some kind of support is that some people are threatened into his regime, like either they join him or they're dead, or their uncle is killed or their father is killed. There's been lots of threats to get people to join his forces. But also, of course, what do people want? People want to be able to send their children off to school without being afraid that they should be killed on the way, and they want to sleep at night, and they want to be able to live their own life. And whether that is under a dictator, that is at least those who are left alone and not politically active, so that they are in danger, they might think that this is now it's a time that we can almost relax. Mm.
And is it correct to say, would it be correct to say that Kadyrov also was a child of war? He was in his young teens, I believe, when the first war broke out.
Definitely. He was a fighter since the age of 13, 14 years old, joining his father. His father was a very respected religious leader in Chechnya, joining the resistance in the first war. And then in the second war, from 1999, he was, one might say, bought up by Moscow, so he joined the Moscow side, and with his son by his side fighting with him. And the father was killed in a explosion, terror attack in 2004, and that's when his son just took over, appointed again by Vladimir Putin. And this is a man As I mentioned, without any skills, he's very much ridiculed in the Russian media because he doesn't really speak even Russian. Even this is a part of Russia, and he's very with very little education, but with a terrible brutality. And it seems to me that why did Vladimir Putin, member of the European Council, you know, Russia trying to play a role on the international stage? How can he put a torturer at the top of this very war-torn republic? And it seems that only a man like Kadyrov can have, he's so brutal so that the republic is stable. Because if a hand raises up or if a head raises up to protest, it's being chopped off. And after a while, people are just dead afraid. Just like in the 30s in Russia, under Stalin, it was also stable. There was no protest because people were just so afraid. And this is a very similar situation today in Chechnya, the police state, and people live under surveillance. So with this, a person like that, Putin can show to the world, or now Medvedev can show to the world, that we have won the war in Chechnya. We have a law and order inside of our borders, and they don't seem to care of the human rights movement who are telling a very different story.
Mm. Back to 1995, early in the year, you were watching things unfold in Chechnya on television, and this was a point in time where the Russian media had the freedom to edit their own coverage, to do their own coverage, and they were responsible for what they put out on the air, not the state. So you decide, I've got to go. I've got to go to Chechnya. Not long after landing, you know, you're really in a very dangerous situation, and you're asking yourself this question, what the hell am I doing here? Now, fast forward to the time you returned, what led you to decide, first of all, to stay back in 1995, and then why did you want to go back almost 10 years later?
Well, I had more or less, this is why I came back, I'd more or less forgotten about Chechnya, just like, you know,
like all of us,
the rest of world media. Yes, we got the Balkans and then Afghanistan and Iraq, so there were lots of wars to cover. And then in 2005, I was actually going to move to the States to write about America, but then I saw this movie about Chechnya, and walking home from the movie theater, I was thinking, I have to do something about this. I have to tell the world, because now that I do have a voice, I have readers, I have a publisher, you know, it was almost kind of a sense of duty that a few people with still an interest in Chechnya, I should go and do that, and went down in a very different way from when I went in 95, when I was hitchhiking with military planes and got a seat among the troops, and as I mentioned about the reign of Boris Yeltsin, everything was chaotic, but also everything was possible. But these years, I realized I was not allowed even to get close to Chechnya, because then you needed hundreds of different accreditations that I would never get unless I traveled on a group tour organized by the Russian authorities. Of course, with the hand-picked interviews and places to go. So the way I could go down now is I went hiddenly in disguise as a Chechen woman, and the book was written very much undercover, just living in people's houses and just moving when I was not being seen, and going around with a headscarf and Chechen clothes. And so it was done very hiddenly. And this is, remember, this is still Russia. And this is how you need to work in Russia to report. But you asked me why I stayed in my very first war when I was just 24, 25. I think there's something that I'm a very curious person, and it's just like I believe that everything will go right in the end. And of course, I always regret when I'm in when I'm being shot at, or if there's a very dangerous situation. But I think the same in Baghdad during the war, when most of the journalists fled Baghdad before the bombing started, and I was like, well, I just couldn't make myself leaving. So I think it's curiosity is stronger than my fear in a way.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you for your work and for the time you put in. I mean, you really get into a situation and you hang in there. And I think it's a really work that needs to be done. So thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you for talking about it with me.
And here we have to wrap up. What's coming up next for you?
Well, I'm for the moment just living my own life because I got a baby. So now I will now sit back and read what other people have been writing, and I will not for a while not go out on any major reporting myself. But there's lots of stories out there, but I probably the time of the front lines are maybe over, so I'll try to find stories a little bit behind the front lines.
Oh, I wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you.
Azni Sirstad has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author most recently of The Angel of Grozny, Orphans of a Forgotten War. The book is published by Basic Books.
And that interview from the AM 580 archives comes from October 27th of this year. It's 8.5 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in now from the Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And with the grain numbers, here's AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at those numbers, Thomas. They settled in Chicago on a Monday afternoon. Futures in the wheat pit at $5.69. Settled 5.75 higher for the soft red. A high today at 5.70 1/4 in that particular contract, to a low of 5.57 1/2. Settlement price $5.69, up 5.75 for the March soft red winter wheat. May futures at 5.82 1/2 on the high, the low at 73. Settlement price 5.81 1/2, 5.5 cents higher in July. That's the harvest month, 5.94 1/2 the high. Low at 5.83 1/4, settlement price at 5.93 1/2. July wheat up 5.75 for the day. September contract, a high today of 6.14 3/4, low at 6.04. Settlement price 6.13 3/4, a nickel higher. And in Kansas City, the hard red winter wheat settled the March contract 6.25 cents higher at $5.89 1/4. Spring wheat settled the March at 6.25 1/4, down 5.75. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby March contract, a penny gain today, 3.86 1/4 the high, the low at 76 1/4. Settlement price $3.81 3/4, up 1 cent. May 3.96 1/4 the high, the low at 3.86 3/4. Settlement price at 3.92, up a penny. In July futures, 4.06 1/4 on the high, low at 3.97 1/2. Settlement price at 4.02 1/2, up 1.5. September futures from the corn pit, 4.14 1/4 the high, the low at $4.09. Settlement price 4.12 3/4, up a penny and 3/4. In December, 4.30 1/2 the high, the low at 20 3/4. Settlement price at $4.27, up 2 on the afternoon. Soy complex, January beans, $8.95 the high, low at 8.62 1/4. Settlement price 8.86 1/2, up 18 1/4. March at 8.99 on the high, the low at 8.66 1/2. Settlement price $8.90 1/2, 18 cents higher. In May futures, 9.10 the high, the low at 8.78. Settlement price $9.5, up 17 3/4. July soybeans 9.21 the high, the low at 8.91 1/2. Settlement price for the July at 9.12 1/2, up 17 1/2 cents. And the November for next year settled at 17 1/4 cents higher. November beans, a high today of 9.22, a low at 8.91 3/4. Settlement price at $9.16 1/4, up 17 1/4 on the afternoon. January bean meal futures, 276.30 the high, the low at 264.90. Settlement price at 275.50, $8 higher. March futures, a $275.80 tops, the bottom at 264.80. Settlement price at 274.90, up $7.50. January bean oil, 31.80 the high, the low at 30.44. A settlement price at 30.94, up 34 cents. In March futures, 31.99 the high, the low at 30.80. Settlement price at 31.25. 34 cents higher on the afternoon. I'll be back at 10 after the hour, or rather 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. It's a bit more than 10 minutes away now. Kurt Kimmel is away this afternoon, but we'll talk with Pete Manhart. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. We'll discuss commodity markets with him. The folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County will join us to take up the cash grain market. Dave Dickey will be along with all the ag news. And I'll remind you again of the Corn and Soybean Classic Series that's coming in January. That's the U of I Extension Crop Production and Protection Series. If you haven't signed up for it yet, still time to do that online. You have to pre-register if you want. The cost is $65 now for that particular set of meetings, but it's an awfully good set. I'll tell you all the details a bit later in the program. Again, recapping the numbers from the Board of Trade, up about a nickel in the wheat pit. Corn futures were narrowly unchanged today, up a penny to 3 cents for the day. Soybeans gained about 18 cents. Back in 10 minutes, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And now the numbers from the livestock side of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange as it wound up the Monday before the holiday. The market was mainly lower, the exception being the pork bellies. Today, the live cattle contract for December had a high of 86.50. The low price today, 85.20. Settlement at 85.97.5, down 12.5 cents on the day. February live cattle, the high 87.05. The low 85.72.5. Settled at 86.25, down 52.5. April live cattle at a high of 89.40, the low 88.35, settlement price 88.82.5, down 37.5, and June had a high of 85.60, the low 84.85, and the settlement 85.02.5, down 55 cents. In the feeder cattle pit, January had a high of 94.10, the low 92.95, the settlement price at 93.37.5, down 12.5. March at 93.80 for the high, the low price 92.30, 92.92.5, the settlement down 30. April feeders had a high of 94.50, the low 93.50, settlement price 94.07.5, down 17.5. And the May contract had a high of 95.40, the low 94.25, and the settlement price wound up at 94.80, down 30. The February lean hog contract had a high of 61.75, the low 60.80, settlement at 60.90, that was down 80 cents. April lean hogs had a high of 69.40, the low 68.60, settlement at 68.70, just above the low, down 75 cents on the day. May contract had a high of 78.30, the low 77.95, the settlement 78.10, down 37.5. And June at a high of 79.30, the low 78.80, settlement price 78.92.5, down 67.5 cents. And the loan up contract today, the February pork belly contract on the Merck, had a high today of 91.80, a low of 89.10, and the settlement at 91.70. That was up 220 on the day. Quick recap of Wall Street right now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 119 points, or about 1.3% at 84.60. The NASDAQ is down 49 points, almost 3%, or more than 3%, at 1515. The S&P Index down 22 at 866.
Almost every Christmas gift comes in a box that's often made in China, out of the paper we all throw away. But now the bottom has fallen out of the waste paper market.
The material that was selling for, you know, $150 a ton was now selling for $20. I mean, that was pretty breathtaking. We had not seen that kind of behavior happen before.
Why that could be bad news for the environment, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 p.m.
Right near Christmas Eve afternoon, with the moving, insightful, surprising, and sometimes even life-changing stories in this year's Third Coast Festival. The best new documentaries produced worldwide are featured, along with producer interviews and highlights from the annual awards ceremony. Gwen Maxey is your host for the Third Coast Festival. That's Wednesday afternoon from 1 to 3 at this time on Christmas Eve here on AM 580, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. I'm Tom Rogers. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. NPR News comes up in a couple minutes, followed by the closing market report. And then the afternoon magazine continues. Our forecast from meteorologist Dan Pounder for the rest of the afternoon, a bitterly cold day, high of only around 14 degrees, but sunny, and wind chills are still below zero by and large. For tonight, clouding up again with a chance of some light snow toward tomorrow morning. The low temperature overnight 10, then early temperature for the low at 10, then the temperatures will slowly rise overnight. Winds out of the south at 10 to 15 miles an hour for this evening. Into tomorrow, light snow in the morning, changing to light sleet and freezing rain as we reach a high of 32 degrees. We could see less than an inch of sleet or snow. Winds out of the south